Hello, Boyles and Ghouls. I wanted to take a quick moment to thank you all for your donations to our fundraiser. We've made some great progress, and it's all thanks to you. We still have a little bit to go, so if you're able, please head to www.helpchilling.org to contribute. By doing so, you're helping us continue to make the world a bit spookier. Now, on to the show.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. In particular, tonight's episode features a scene of self-harm. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody. Tonight, we're featuring an author that's new to the show, brought to us by our friends over at Velux Books. This evening, I present to you two stories by Michael Squid. To whet your appetite, we'll start with a short piece titled The Hidden Television Channel, in which our narrator and his older brother discover something unexpected and deadly one day while channel surfing. Following that, we'll jump into a longer piece, A Beginner's Guide to Blood Portals. In this story, our narrator receives a text from his eccentric cousin, followed by a photograph that is as bizarre as it is terrifying. Racing over to check on him, our protagonist soon dives down one of the strangest rabbit holes that he can imagine. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Michael Squid, I give you The Hidden Television Channel. I've long held a memory that has been the source of pain and anguish throughout my life since childhood. My psychiatrist has convinced my memories are warped in an attempt to suppress trauma, and I began to believe him. I've been on anti-anxiety medication for nearly 22 years and antidepressant meds for 18. I'd eventually been convinced those memories were, in fact, a result of suppression, and I was finally starting to move past it all. And then, this afternoon, I saw it. I saw the hidden television channel I'd been convinced was a false memory, and I screamed. My brother went missing when I was 9 years old, and his friend was found dead in our living room. I was questioned, as was my father, but the nature of Dan's death defied explanation, and the lack of evidence made the case unsolvable, so it went cold. I was considered an unreliable witness after my tearful testimony to the police. In the following months, I was taken to a child psychologist and eventually prescribed medications before undergoing years of repressed memory therapy. I was there when it happened, though, and as of today, I'm now certain that what I saw was, in fact, real. My parents raised Ryan and me in the suburb of Hatfield, Pennsylvania. We had a yard, good education, good friends, and the latest 16-bit video game consoles. I was happy at age 9, enjoying the summer vacation as the sweltering heat of June baked the streets. My older brother, Ryan, was 14 and a bit of a smartass, always cracking jokes and getting into trouble. Still, he looked after me and was always quick to stick up for me if any bullies made the mistake of giving me a hard time. I truly was lucky, in retrospect. One weekend, when Dad was working and Mom had driven off to run errands, I was playing Genesis in my room when Ryan began yelling from downstairs. "Mike, get down here, check this out!" he called up from the living room. I heard the din of scattered applause from the TV. I shuffled out of my room and peered down at Ryan, who flashed me his trademark smile, marked by the mole on his cheek. It had been a sore spot growing up and led to him growing thick skin after being called Marilyn Monroe many times in elementary school. I looked past my grinning brother to the TV, to an image that warped and shifted like a scrambled adult station, bending the image. "Yeah, Dad locks the porn channel, perv," I called back. I shook my head, but then the image on the TV fixed itself. On screen, there was a panel of sitting people whose faces looked somehow wrong. They had all the normal features, eyes, noses, and mouths, but they looked strangely shaped and sized, like each was in the wrong place or perhaps the wrong shape. They looked deformed and almost fake. It was pretty creepy. "What the heck is it?" I asked. "Just come down here, check this out," Ryan called and sat cross-legged in front of the glowing screen. I was curious and had nothing better to do, so I shuffled my small feet down the carpeted stairs and stood next to Ryan, watching the strange people on screen. "This is not a real station," Ryan stated emphatically. "Look!" His finger pointed to the corner of the screen. The station read 23.3, a station in between stations. He then pointed to the dial. Our TV was one of the old-fashioned dial sets. The knob was resting between stops. "And this show is fucking weird." I then sat next to my brother as the image went in and out of scrambled distortion, and we watched a TV show unlike anything I'd seen before. Seven individuals with strange-looking faces all conversed in whispers between themselves. A shiny-faced, bald man who appeared to be the show's host paced back and forth in front of a large reflective black panel on the wall. The image bent and shifted as the scrambled effect came in and out, but I soon realized it was a large square of black glass, maybe 12 feet square and likely fairly thick as well. After some deliberation, the seated individuals on the panel held up large cards with numbers from left to right. 3, 21, 53, 501, 413, 8, 42. I had no idea what those numbers could possibly mean, but I began to feel nervous. The people with pinched and strange features creeped me out more than anything. It was like they had all received severely botched plastic surgeries, warping them so far out of normal proportion that they all looked terrifying. "What is this?" I asked Ryan, who shushed me. "I don't know. Stop talking," he snapped. The camera switched to show a close-up of the standing man, the presumed host. My skin crawled immediately once his close-up filled the screen. Ryan gasped and then said, "Fuck," under his breath. Fuck was right. The man was bald, and the close-up revealed the skin on his grisly face was made up almost entirely of scar tissue. Shiny pink skin was pulled tight around the contours of his skull. It was reminiscent of a burn victim who's had his damaged skin grafted, but in a way that didn't make any logical sense. His teeth were pristine, sparkling white, but his lips were jagged, blended, and uneven, as if they'd been split and patched together by unskilled surgeons. It was like some horrifically butchered cosmetic surgery had been performed on him for the sole purpose of making him look more disturbing. The host peered into the camera with small black eyes beneath folded creases of misshapen lids, little black beads that stared into me from the flickering screen. My neck hairs raised as he cocked his head slightly, as if he'd become aware of something. I held my breath as he then excitedly pointed at the camera and spoke.
2913! 2913!
The host called out in a muffled, strained voice through butchered lips. My brother and I looked at each other in shock. Our address was 2913 on our lane. It was surely just a creepy coincidence, but I was 9 years old and absolutely terrified at that point. "Turn it off!" I shouted, but Ryan just gawked, his jaw hanging open as he watched the TV. The host pointed a twisted finger to the audience, a slew of about 20 individuals whose backs were to the camera. The person who'd been pointed at then stood and turned to the side to move down the aisle. It was a woman who looked sickly and tired. She was gaunt, emaciated, with bags under her eyes above sunken cheeks. Her age was a mystery, as her face had been mangled similarly to the rest. There was no way to tell if she was 25 or 85. She dragged one foot behind her as the host kept pointing a gnarled finger at her. As she shuffled out of the aisle and onto the path toward the stage, it was clear her left foot was dangling at the base, connected only by the skin itself. "Jesus Christ," Ryan exhaled in a hushed voice. The woman limped up the stairs to the black-floored stage and made her way to the panel, taking a seat at the end of the strange-looking individuals. A wide-angled shot showed a black-clad assistant rush over from behind a curtained stage left and hand her a placard reading 2913 in thick black numbers. These did not look like special effects, and they were far too graphic for television, as far as I knew.
"Turn it off!"
I shouted to Ryan, but he seemed mesmerized by the bizarre television show. The camera then showed a close-up of the woman holding the sign, and my heart pounded in my chest. It wasn't a woman. It was a mutilated girl, much younger, but cosmetically butchered just like the rest. Her face was scarred in lines under the eyes and cheeks, making her appear older. She looked very familiar, however. It took me a while to figure out where I recognized that nose speckled with that particular pattern of freckles. I made the connection as my stomach sank into the floor. It was Amber Darden, the girl who'd been all over the news after having gone missing, presumed abducted from her front yard last year. I'd seen her face so many times in the papers, post office wall, and even milk cartons that there was no mistaking it. It was impossible to ignore. Her face had been terribly altered in what appeared to be an attempt to conceal her identity.
"Ryan, that's Amber Darden, the girl who went missing,"
I whimpered. I couldn't stand it anymore.
"Ryan, call the police!"
Fuck, you're right. Holy shit. Ryan stood up, stumbled back, and raced to the cordless kitchen phone. He picked it up and dialed. But just seconds later, the image on screen warped back into wavy bands of a scrambled station before clicking to channel 23, where a baseball game was being aired.
"No!"
I shouted, and I approached the old TV set, hitting the side to try and restore the image. I fiddled with the knob, trying to balance it between stations, but it wouldn't stick or find that hidden station, no matter how slowly I rotated the dial. That strange show didn't come back. Not when my mother returned home and listened to our pleas to believe us. Not when a uniformed police officer arrived at our door. This made our mother really lose it, once she explained the hyperactive imagination of her boys and forced us to apologize to the man. Nobody
believed us. Ryan and I both were determined to find the station throughout the week, but had no luck. The dial clicked very clearly between the actual stations, and the phenomenon Ryan had discovered seemed to have been a one-time fluke. "Might have been pirate broadcasters," Ryan told me one day. "Back in 87, hackers did it in Chicago with a Max Headroom mask. I don't know." He sounded like he was desperately trying to get over it and dismiss it as a prank or a fluke. I don't think he wanted to face the possibility that what we saw was real. Days passed, and I honestly thought that was the end of it. God, I wish it had been. A few days later, Ryan's friend Dan from school came over, and they watched horror movies late at night after Mom and Dad were asleep. I sneak watched The Thing from atop the stairs without them knowing. After it was finished, they began chatting about strange real-life horror stories and unexplained phenomena. Then, Ryan brought up the show. "There's a hidden television station. Swear to God, my little brother and I both saw it," Ryan explained to the scoffs of Dan, a larger kid who always wore leather jackets and fancied himself the long-lost member of the Misfits. "Bullshit," Dan retorted after hearing the rundown of events. He smirked, then shook his head. "If the station existed, hundreds or even thousands of people would have seen it." "I swear it was real, man." Ryan walked up to the TV and began fiddling with the station knob. We'd done this a dozen times since the incident, and of course, there was never any signal again. Dan was chuckling as he drew a Marlboro from a pack in his jacket pocket and headed to the door to go out for a smoke. But then, it happened. There was a pop of static, a crackle as the image flickered, and then wavy bands of color streaked down the screen. Dan stopped mid-step, the unlit cigarette dangling from his lip. "Holy shit, this is it!" Ryan yelled out in a hushed tone to avoid waking our parents. I felt my guts squirm at the sight of it. It was something dangerous, something too dark to explore. Ryan and his tough guy friend Dan were the type to chase thrills, though. I watched from the top of the stairs as those sickening faces appeared once again on the screen. The panel of disfigured individuals and that shiny-skinned host with beady eyes and perfect teeth beneath the ravaged flesh of his face. "What the actual fuck?" Dan trailed off, and he came back into the living room to watch the horrible show. "This is fucking crazy." I watched for a few seconds as the panel of individuals raised placards with numbers. 814-2-601-21B-3F-210-2002. The host faced the screen once more in a grotesque close-up. I twinged with a shiver at seeing that terrible, butchered face staring intently into the camera, squinting malformed lids over shiny black eyes.
2913! 2913! Quick!
He pointed a gnarled finger to an emaciated male in the audience, who staggered slowly up and onto the stage to hold a newly painted card reading 2913, our address. My throat closed and my heart pounded in my chest. The host then walked to the large black glass square inset into the stage. I felt sick to my stomach, but couldn't look away. The black square pane of glass began to brighten as if a light was being turned on from the other side. The illumination revealed a room of a house and two people facing the camera. My heart skipped a beat as I realized what I was seeing. Behind the glass was a reflection of our living room, as viewed from the other side. Standing in it, facing the audience, was my brother Ryan and his friend Dan.
"What the fuck, man?"
Dan shouted and took a step back from the screen. His actions were mirrored in the large square panel, as if it were a window into our home. There was a harsh, distorted tone that rumbled through the TV, low and deep. It sounded for a second, stopped for two, then sounded again on repeat. My fear had built to the point that I couldn't take it. "Turn it off!" I shouted from atop the stairs, only then alerting my brother and his friend to my presence. That analog, deep rumbling tone kept sounding, and my brother ran to the TV, fidgeting with the dial. The image remained as he switched stations. It remained even after he pressed the power button. "This can't be real," Ryan said. He yanked out the plug of the television, and the screen finally went black with a crackle. But then, the tones sounded again, distorted and deep, rumbling loud enough to tremble the upstairs floor beneath the carpet. There was a sharp bang followed by the cracking of wood. Ryan screamed a shrill scream, facing the out-of-view front door of our home. I ran into my room and slammed my door shut, locking it with shaking fingers. There was a horrible series of snaps and crunches, followed by the most terrible, shrill scream I've ever heard. Everything after was a blur. I remember my parents' voices, confused by the sounds that awoke them, my mother's scream, frantic yelling, my parents checking if I was okay. Sirens, police, ambulances. Everyone was asking if I knew where Ryan was. I did not. Dan was found splayed on the carpet. His wrists, ankles, and neck had been severed clean through, though the skin remained unscathed. It was as if they'd been severed from within his body. His official cause of death was listed as internal hemorrhaging, though how he got his injuries was a complete mystery. And that was the end of it. I grew up into a scarred adult with some issues due to the trauma. I have an Ativan with breakfast and Paxil at lunch. I've been to therapy sessions through my teenage years and into my adult life. I was convinced there must have been some crazy trick, or perhaps my mind had envisioned what it most feared on that screen. Ryan was presumed kidnapped and killed. We even had a funeral for him 7 years after the incident, once he was legally declared dead in absentia. I hadn't seen or heard from him in 30 years. Not until this afternoon. Today, I was scouring the news and forcing down a TV dinner. I was flicking the stations, not paying attention to the channel, only to what was on. News, cooking, cartoons. And then my blood froze. I stared at the image I'd struggled all my life to convince myself was a delusion, a vivid hallucination, or some transfigured, repressed memory. The station read 23.3, and the familiar, nightmarish television set appeared once again. It was that same studio stage and a row of disfigured people who appeared to have had horrific plastic surgeries. They were all new, butchered faces, but the exact same setup. The host was a bald, heavily scarred man, but clearly a different person. I watched the familiar routine of raising signs of street addresses when the close-up cam fixed on the mutilated visage of the host.
21B! 21B!
He gurgled frantically, his crooked finger aiming at the screen before lowering to single out a woman in the audience. My heart stumbled in my chest until it hurt. My throat dried and my eyes widened with dread. I felt the icy claw of horror trace down my spine. I lived in apartment 21B on my street, but it wasn't the address that sent me screaming out of my apartment door, down the stairs and into the streets. It was the butchered face of the host. It was the unmistakable mole on his mutilated cheek. You've been listening to The Hidden Television Channel by Michael Squid. And now, also from Mr. Michael Squid, I present A Beginner's Guide to Blood Portals. A few days ago, I got a text message from an unknown number reading, "I got your proof." I stared at the words for a bit, thinking it was a wrong number, but then I remembered the last time I'd spoken to Jeremy. Jeremy, my younger cousin, was a character, to say the least. He was always an eccentric rebel, the black sheep of the family who dabbled in drugs and acquired a criminal record, bouncing from job to job and always teetering on homelessness. He'd been the first to get tattoos and piercings, and was really into noise and industrial music, and the few friends of his I ever met gave me the creeps. He introduced me to weed before he moved on to much harder stuff as the years passed. He was also a total conspiracy theorist, convinced of chemtrails and UFOs, etc. You name it, he drank the Kool-Aid. The last time I'd spoken to him was after Thanksgiving dinner a few years ago. We'd smoked a bowl after dinner at my uncle's house about 3 years ago before the argument. He'd been driveling on about alternate planes of existence. He tried to convince me that all religions were based on what he believed to be cracks in this plane of reality. Jeremy was the type to try and heal a broken ankle with crystals before snorting a Xanax, mind you, so I was used to tuning him out. He kept pressing on, ignoring my rebuttals of scientific facts and basic physics. He kept pushing my buttons, calling me closed-minded and shallow, and I just snapped at him. "Yeah? Prove it then, instead of just ranting on like some delusional burnout failure," I'd yelled at him. I bit my lower lip and cringed, and I immediately apologized, but it was out there. He looked at me with a dark stare from under a veil of greasy, black bangs, and I saw the twinge in his eyes. With a conviction that rattled me, he said, "I will, Mike. I will, and you'll see just how ignorant you are." I tried to apologize, but he stormed off into his car, slamming the door and driving off. In the following months, I emailed him a few times in an attempt to mend it, but he never responded. Not until this. "Jeremy?" I typed, and soon got a response. "I got your proof right here," came the reply a few minutes later. A picture arrived, and I opened it while a feeling of unease sat cold in my stomach. Jeremy faced the camera, his intense eyes staring in at me. He looked jaundiced, gaunt, and underslept, but my concern soon shifted to the crimson bands glazing his forearm. He was holding a razor blade in his other hand, dripping red with blood. It appeared he'd slit his wrist. "Jeremy, oh fuck, what did you do?" I asked aloud, choked with tears. I dialed him. No answer. I ran to my coat and slid it on, listening as panic built while each ring went unanswered. I'd found the email from years ago that contained his address, and soon jogged over to my Nissan and hopped in, plugging the address in and trying him repeatedly. 28 minutes away. I steered wide out of my driveway and drove dangerously fast towards his house. I kept texting him and ringing him to no response, following the turns dictated aloud by the GPS as I sped up a hilly incline on the outskirts of his town. I prayed no cop would pull me over and that it wasn't too late. I'd lost a friend early in the year from an OD, and my cousin was not leaving me with this guilt trip. After about 20 minutes, I was at the edge of his town. Tall pines gave fractured glimpses of dilapidated homes built in the 60s and long since neglected. Sagging roofs, missing tiles, and peeling paint peeked out as if ashamed of their condition. Soon, his house came into view. I'd never visited his home before. If I had, I might have bit my tongue that Thanksgiving when I'd lashed out. It was a depressing shack of a place, smaller than all the other worn-down homes on the street. I pulled into the short driveway, observing the dozens of stacked boxes and rusted bicycle parts littering the lawn, and ran out of the car to the wooden steps. I pounded on the flimsy screen door and shouted, "Jeremy, I'm here, let's talk!" But received no reply, just the swaying branches of tall pines whispering in the wind. I tried the door. Open. I ran in and immediately covered my mouth and nose from the stench. It was like an outhouse had been overturned. The sour ammonia stench of piss and rotting food was overwhelming. "Jeremy?" I shouted and squeezed past the pillars of water-damaged magazines, wafting out spores of mildew and mold from room to filthy room. Old microwave dinners grew fuzzy and green in teetering stacks, and I saw cat food cans littering the hovel, but no signs of a cat. Then I heard a wet, sickening, slapping sound coming from upstairs. I rounded the corner to see the filthy carpeted stairs. No sign of what the original color had been beneath a tar-like gray buildup that had fused with the fabric. They creaked loudly as I ran up. I almost expected the bending wood beneath to buckle in and snap, but I made it to the top and followed that aqueous sloshing sound towards a room glowing yellow from a solitary bulb. I ran in and stopped dead in my tracks. There was Jeremy, soaking red and wet with blood in a black t-shirt on the floor. Not on the floor, inside of it. I first thought him to be sliced in half. Blood spilled out in all directions like a crimson mirror, and he was bisected diagonally from his upper right hip to his left armpit. He was sinking down into the floor. I was stunned, too stunned to do anything but weakly mutter his name. "Jeremy?" with a shiver as I watched him smile. Lower, he sank into the red pool of what was likely his own blood. Soon, only his shoulder and head remained with the solitary arm dripping red. I ran over and grabbed his hand, feeling the warm blood, and he slipped from my grasp. I watched in absolute disbelief as he sank, then vanished completely. I stared in bewilderment and horror, my brain refusing to comprehend what was completely impossible. Then I saw the book. A worn hardcover book lay near his cell phone, wallet, and other personal effects. A Beginner's Guide to Blood Portals was written in a flowing font from the 60s on a purple marbled cover that looked stained by blooms of dried blood. I was in shock. I walked with legs drained of strength over to the book, picking it up in my shaky hands. I flipped it over to read the synopsis. None. Then I opened it up to the print details. None. No author, no date, just an index of the chapters. 1. Knowing. 2. Preparing. 3. Surveying. 4. Tethering. 5. Returning. I flipped the page and read the first two paragraphs. Chapter 1. Knowing. There is an imperceptible tissue separating the connecting folds between realms of existence. Our proteins and cells are just one of the millions of locking mechanisms that tether us to our current plane. By manipulating the frequency and adjusting the vibration of the content of our own bodily content, synchronization can be achieved. A 3-foot blood pool, representing about 1.5 liters shed blood, on a non-porous surface should be sufficient in size. Coumarin or dicoumarol should be mixed at 0.5 parts per liter in order to prevent coagulation, which can lead to temporal warping within and the sealing of windows prematurely. See footnote on Severed Pathways, page 143. The electronic stimulation of a pointing vector is needed in order to maintain an open vortex via an assisting magnetic field. An oscillating frequency of 800 megahertz needs to be maintained, or shifting occurs. See page 68. I closed the book with one hand and tugged the hair from my scalp with the other, trying to convince myself this was all just some strange dream. I stared at the reflective pool of still blood and noticed two wires insulated with black rubber. They were leading out and into a humming metal box near an empty plastic blood bag. I scanned the filthy room, spotted an ancient broom, and picked it up, holding it over the pool with hesitation. I lowered it down, feeling it connect with the wooden floor beneath the few millimeters of the blood with a dull tap. My heart pounding, I then lowered to a knee and splayed my fingers out over the pool, staring into my own wide-eyed reflection. I lowered my palm slowly, half expecting a painful electric shock. I felt my arm hairs raise as my hand descended 1 centimeter at a time until it connected with the dark fluid blood. I watched in both absolute amazement and horror as my hand pressed below where the floor should be. Warm blood covered my submerged hand, then wrist. I laughed, a nervous, terrified laugh. Then I pulled my hand out, now slick with a red coat. Jeremy was inside of there. He'd chosen to risk death in order to show me there was something beyond explanation, and clearly there was. I lowered my face to the reflective puddle, staring at my own worried visage as it got closer and closer. I felt the hot liquid on my nose and cheeks, and I plunged my face into what should have been the floor. It was impossible, yet I opened my eyelids and I saw it. There was a mirrored red room I stared into within the puddle. The room was the exact size and shape, but made of what appeared to be carved black stone, monolithic and ancient. It was preposterous and impossible, but I plunged my head down further, feeling the wetness against my skin, and I watched as the room's walls and ceiling seemed to pulse and shift. I shouted out for Jeremy and tasted the tangy copper flood my mouth. My words were muffled, muted by the density of the thick, liquid-like air in this impossible place. Then I heard a deep moan, gurgling and inhuman, and forged from lungs that had to be at least twice the size of mine. Claustrophobia hit me, and I lifted my head from the puddle and gasped for air. I pulled over a chair to skim over the book that casually discusses travel between these strange alternate planes. It mentioned things that can rend apart the human mind with madness, echoing chambers that cause feedback of physical matter, sentient beings that hunt, and other anomalies, all outside of our spectrum of tangible reality. I shivered as I stared at that impossible puddle, terrified of what I'd glimpsed into. I couldn't wrap my head around any of it, but options lessened as time ticked by. At some point, that puddle was going to dry. An electromagnetically charged puddle of my cousin Jeremy's blood sat on the floor before me. I opened my photo app on my phone, switched it to video mode, and lowered it into the pool of blood, twisting it around. My neck hairs stood on end as I stared at my arm, which, against all logic, seemed to disappear just past the elbow. When I removed my dripping red phone, it was dead. I cursed, then ran over to Jeremy's phone on the side of the puddle, realizing with a sigh of relief he had no password on the device. He'd left it alongside his wallet, a coiled $5 bill dusted with powder, and a stained keychain crafted from a dead bird's skull. "Jesus, Jeremy," I muttered, then tried to breathe slowly to ease my rapidly beating heart. I flipped the strange book open to the next chapter in search of any helpful information. Chapter 2. Preparing. Anchoring. A rope, wire, or chain anchor should be secured in order to connect with and return to an adjacent plane. Failure to anchor may result in a shifting that can both sever the path and bend the matter within. This means you. Just as neurons, muscle cells, and endocrine cells emit negative 40 millivolts to negative 80 millivolts, all matter inorganic in nature should carry a 40 to 80 millivolt charge or be coated with hemoglobin or other cellular tissue in order to maintain the current. Breathing. I, full inhalation. E, full exhalation. S, slight exhalation. Patterned breathing of ISIE, ISIE, repeat, must be practiced and performed in order to prevent suffocation and death. Your blood oxygen level should typically vary between 75 and 100 millimeters Hg. A significant decrease in your blood oxygen saturation levels will result in rapid suffocation and death. Circumventing. It is imperative to avert one's gaze when in the presence of most of the entities within. These pathways and inhabitants exist beyond our logic and understanding. Attempts to comprehend them can and will ravage the minds of those who traverse these planes. Failure of the autonomic nervous system will follow, leading to respiratory failure, suffocation, and death. Undocumented hostile beings dwell in the dimensional folds, scavenging for protein in any form. This means you. If any physical contact is made, death will likely ensue. The alphabetical list went on with dozens of pages of additional hazards and threats. Solidification of the atmosphere leading to an eviscerated body. Being caught in a temporal field causing the body to implode. Being stuck inside a feedback loop of folding space and crushing the explorer. Shifting doors causing the amputation of limbs. Coagulating edges of the windows leading to solidification of bodily fluids. The list continued for 12 pages filled with hundreds of horrific scenarios. I skimmed through, shivering from a combination of anxiety and wonder at the pages of the guidebook. Time was short. If I was to attempt a rescue of my cousin, I'd need to read it along the way. In the boxes of filth near the wall of the room, I found medical clutter I could only assume Jeremy had stolen. I gathered a few anticoagulants and blood packs marked CPDA solution with shaky hands. The bird's beak of Jeremy's morbid keychain made a quick tool to puncture a blood packet, gushing out the thick red liquid from within onto the book. I scoured the adjacent rooms of the house and eventually found a coil of twine to anchor myself to the room, squeezed the contents of the blood transfer bag over the rope, then slathered its bristly fibers with my bare, bloody hands. I tied the stained red cord to a door handle, then returned to the dark spill, realizing without care just how utterly insane I must have looked, covered in blood and daubing it over seemingly random objects. I peered into that reflective crimson pool, and the humor vanished. That blood stain in the making would likely be my tomb. As uncomfortable as it was, I practiced that odd manner of breathing, trying to maintain the peculiar rhythm a few times until it felt natural. I stared into the black spill, deliberating. Then, I jumped in. My senses fought to comprehend my falling into the mirrored room of air, thick and fluid. A vermilion haze gradated into black nooks and shadows, tracing the contours of what looked to be ornately carved coral with strange geometry. Every accent, corner, and angle repeated in a fractal pattern that echoed in an artistic beauty that was both mesmerizing and terrifying. My hands flowed through the rippling current of dense, dark air, and I felt pressure from every angle on my skin that felt impossibly dry. I heard a soft hum, the buzzing rumble from the oscillator's current. I looked down at the mirrored ceiling and over to the door to the adjacent room. I felt my lungs ache and realized I wasn't breathing. The twine was gripped firmly in my tight fist, and my heart beat against my chest. I could hear it as if underwater, yet I was neither in liquid nor air. I closed my eyes, blocking out the strange chamber that called to memory ruins of an ancient civilization, and then I tried to breathe. The coppery taste of blood choked me as it filled my mouth when I inhaled the dense air. Panic flared. I was suddenly both lightheaded and terrified as spots formed in my peripheral vision. I was going to drown, suffocate, or die, never to be found in there. And the air thickened as if aware of my rising anxiety. Focus. I opened my eyes wide, feeling that thick, dark air flowing over my eyeballs, and then I concentrated on my lungs and tried again. Breathe in deep. Slight exhale. Breathe in deep. Release. I soon stopped coughing and regained my composure as I focused on the strange, flanging sound of my breathing. The taste was bitter, and I felt the air enter my bronchial tubes within my lungs. It was foreign and violating, painful, yet vital. Slowly, I relaxed into the rhythm and was able to clear my head. I was inside that impossible place, and I was alive. I took a few steps on the strange black rock floor that mirrored the ceiling of the room I'd entered into. That solitary yellow bulb dangling from his room's ceiling was mimicked in this plane, yet it was formed from rectangular bismuth crystals of obsidian stone in a sculpturesque replica. I marveled at the strange formation for only a moment. when I heard a choking scream from through the door in the porous black wall. I walked as quickly as the pressure would allow through the gloomy chamber, uncoiling that coarse twine in my trembling hand. Through the doorway, I saw the limp form of Jeremy in his threadbare t-shirt and jeans. He was clearly unconscious, his eyes rolled back in his head and a grimace fixed on his pale face. It took me a moment to notice the coiling, flaky, white hook of flesh around his ankle. I walked into the long corridor, focusing on the patterned breathing that was keeping me alive. Something was dragging him. I smelled it, like a coppery, peaty stench that tickled my nostril hairs and screamed into my reptilian brain to run. Something I wished I hadn't glimpsed, but I had. Nothing two- or three-dimensional could ever describe that nightmarish form. Teeth sprouted teeth, which in turn sprouted teeth. Eyes spiraled outward in every direction, budding other glistening orbs that weaved into infinite patterns. It resonated with both horror and beauty, seemingly facing every angle simultaneously. My mind's attempts to comprehend it built a sharp, excruciating pain in my temples. I collapsed to my knees as numerous venous tongues twisted out into millions of other smaller, branching duplicates that flicked out from a hideous, amorphic mouth. I had to physically turn my head away with my shaking hands. When I did, I could hear a shrill screaming that I only then realized was coming from my own throat. Breathe in, deep. Slight exhale. Breathe in, deep. Release. I lowered my gaze to the floor, coughing violently as I fought to regain that pattern of irregular breathing. It took a few minutes, and when I looked up only slightly to see where Jeremy was, he was gone, tugged up through a twisting passage of ridged steps in the ceiling that mirrored the stairway down in Jeremy's home. I uncoiled more of that rough twine in my fist, walking closer to the shadowy square hole in the ceiling where it had taken him. From behind me, I heard a deep, bubbling howl, neither animal nor human. I didn't dare turn my head back to look. My only option was to press on. I moved towards the strange passage above, building the courage to climb that porous, dark wall and follow Jeremy's dragged body deeper within. I waded through the thick air, which seemed to glide over my skin with a cold resistance. Intricately patterned walls and doorways shifted slowly into hypnotic new shapes as if alive. The deep bellow of something behind me sounded, and I rushed towards the porous black surface of the wall ahead leading up. I quickly tucked the hardback guidebook into the back of my jeans to free both hands, then began my climb into the dark passage above. I strained to lift myself up the pocked walls that resembled volcanic rock. The sharp surface dug into my fingertips with jagged edges, causing me to hiss in pain as I climbed. The physical exertion caused my breathing to quicken, and I paused to pace myself and regain the pattern of my careful breathing as I continued up into the murky depths of the passage. An unending humming from the oscillating current vibrated the shifting walls, a constant reminder of the high voltage helping to stabilize the impossible place. After a few minutes of climbing, I'd reached another chamber. I breathed in the thick, cold air in that forced pattern and removed the book, flipping it open to try and understand how to proceed. I opened it to the third chapter, skimming over the strange details for insight. Chapter 3. Surveying. Time is precious when within, as the oscillating electric charge will gradually disrupt both cellular balance and function. Ions on the surface of a cell's plasma membrane may experience irreparable cellular degradation after just 25 minutes, so keep any surveying short. I read the words with a slow blink in the thick, dark atmosphere, and I understood the need to hurry. I skimmed through a few paragraphs looking for insight on how to get Jeremy from the thing that nearly cost me my life from simply looking at it. I spotted something a few pages in. Entities within will feed on any foreign source of protein without prejudice. as they have become accustomed to paralytic and comatose prey that unfortunately finds itself within their realm, rapid movement can be used advantageously. I closed the book and tucked it back in my waistband, realizing how critical time was. I raced towards the pale, limp body of Jeremy, barely visible ahead in the shadowy corner of the room. The gurgling moan of whatever had been dragging him deeper within the illogical place made it clear it had no intention of releasing him. I focused my gaze on the moving floor, which grew crystal-like patterns as I watched. By squinting and blurring my vision, I was able to unfocus my eyes as my mind fought to identify that thing dragging him deeper within. In a moment as heroic as it was stupid, I charged, screaming out into the dense vapor of strange dark air, and I reached Jeremy. In a swift motion, I grabbed his ankle and yanked forcefully. An aggressive howl that pierced my ears rang out, twisting and echoing in a maddening cry that trembled through me. But Jeremy was freed. My heart pounded and I began to choke, and I struggled to continue the strange pattern of breathing as I quickly dragged his body across the shifting floor, which now seemed to grow taller rapidly. My heart sank as I realized what was occurring. The portal was collapsing. I dragged Jeremy by a sock that seemed to flake and dissolve under my grasp. I looked down to make sure his leg was still intact, and then I felt a powerful tug that jarred my arm at its socket with a sharp pain. That thing was trying to get its protein back. Time was dwindling, and the crystalline patterns grew rapidly on the floor, climbing over my dissolving sneakers. I screamed once again. The sound stopped short as I yanked back in a strange tug-of-war with Jeremy's unconscious body. With a violent heave that lit up the nerves throughout my arm, I finally freed him. I dragged him back towards the stairwell, and my panic multiplied. The large stairwell, mirrored in ancient black stone, was a fraction of its original size. It was now a narrow tunnel, twisting and warped, shifting in texture rapidly as new layers formed over the animated walls. The twine tether I'd anchored myself with was now thin as a strand of dry spaghetti, frayed and disintegrating before my panicked eyes. There was no time to think. I leaned forward, supported by the dragged body of my cousin, who grunted in a pained moan as he came to. "Hang in there, Jeremy," I called out as I strained to squeeze him through the tunnel of strange collapsing geometry.
"Cyan,"
he mumbled weakly, barely pronouncing his words. I scraped my hands on the wall of that tunnel, which had thinned down to the diameter of a manhole lid, as I pulled my slurring cousin through. "Huh?" I responded, barely able to find the remaining thread of the tether.
"Say, I was right,"
Jeremy mumbled, as if talking in his sleep. I felt my blood pressure rise at the audacity of the request. "Are you fucking kidding me?" I replied, nearly considering letting go of him. "Oh, for fuck's sake, Jeremy! Yeah, you were right. I can say with absolute certainty that this is not a good thing, but you were right. Happy?" I asked and waited for a reply, but there was none. I looked down at him, only to see he'd passed out again. I did a double take when I got a good look at his face, which was now red and flaky as if severely sunburned. Cellular degradation. The words pounded in my head as I understood the severity of the meaning. With a heaving yank that caused a screaming pain in my shoulder, which I soon realized was dislocated, I dragged my cousin into the remainder of the room I'd first entered. It was smaller, built up in patterned layers of crystal-like growth that closed in on the space. I gently dropped my cousin, who splayed on the floor like a rag doll, and I looked up, eager to find the exit above. It wasn't there. I spun around to search the walls. Nothing. The exit to that strange and horrific dimension, collapsing rapidly around us, was gone. I was in a room that no longer had an exit, and the thick air was closing in as it digested my cousin and I alive. "Jeremy!" I shouted, shaking the limp body of my cousin by his shoulders. His face was red and slightly swollen. The proteins in his body were clearly dissolving, and soon I felt a growing itch over my skin. It was faint at first, then the tickle continued to spread into a stinging itch. I reached around the walls for any sign of the twine I'd pulled into this strange, horrific place, but there was none. I flipped open the book and read with shaking hands as I flipped desperately through for answers. Chapter 4. Tethering. Due to the volatile nature of matter within these folds, openings are likely to close upon the tether and obscure the window, which can lead to a quick demise. It is vital to gauge an approximation of the window created and physically move the matter in order to clear the path. Of course, this solution comes with its own setbacks. The rapid degeneration of a fold is coarse and difficult to manipulate. Be sure to bring a tool, preferably metal, as it will degrade at a less rapid rate than porous, less dense materials. See Disintegration of Foreign Matter, page 254. I looked at the strange, vibrating surface of the low ceiling, black and animated like a magnetically triggered ferrofluid. I rushed over and pushed aside the growing mass, feeling the sharp surface that cut into my hands as I pushed it away like metal filings. My hands were bright red, flaking off wisps of thin layers of skin, and the tickle, which had become an itch, was now a stinging pain. I watched in awe as the blood from my hand clouded, forming inky red trails of smoke that floated within the illogical dark air. As horrifying and painful as the experience was, a small part of me was amazed that a world so secretive and hidden, so completely fantastic and impossible, even existed. I pushed away at the heavy, shale-like growth of the living pattern, foot after foot, as if digging into the earth, as I searched for the way out. Just as the pain flared into an unbearable burn, I saw a dim, red glow peeking out from the black buildup. I looked down at my hands, which were split open, revealing puffy red muscle within the lacerations. I looked closer in horror, seeing the white of bone within one of the slivers. When I looked back to Jeremy to make sure he was okay, I shouted in shock at the sight of him. The room was now only a fraction of the size. The chamber we'd come from was entirely blocked over. The room we were in was the size of a small bathroom at this point, and the floor had rapidly grown over Jeremy's unconscious form. His appearance was horrific. His face had deteriorated, stripped raw and red into multiple layers as permanent damage to his skin had clearly taken place. The t-shirt and jeans he'd worn were now spiderwebs of thread, revealing his eaten-away skin that emerged from a cluster of black, polygonal noise. I raced back and hammered away at the buildup, trying my best to chip away the enclosing floor and walls that clung to him like wet asphalt. I screamed from the pain as the sting that spread over my own skin shifted another few degrees on the pain scale into a steady, singing burn. "Jeremy!" I screamed down to his slack face, which at that point was sinking slightly into the black floor. "Jeremy, wake up!" I cried as a knot formed in my stomach. I wasn't even sure he was alive anymore. The portal was closing and swallowing everything within. Every instinct screamed to abandon him, that I'd be sealing my fate and death if I stayed. But I kept clawing away at the living material that closed in until I'd freed him enough to yank him out by a slippery, wet arm. The pain in my own mangled hands distorted the feeling of his arm and mine, but when I looked back down at it, I could see the skin had eroded nearly down to the muscle. I dragged his slippery hand as I climbed the narrow path upward and then continued to chip away at the rapidly closing exit to that hostile rift. I was soon screaming in pain as I clawed at the speedily closing buildup. I felt a snap, refusing to look and register the event I knew was the loss of one of my fingers. I just dug away until the surface was breached. Then I climbed, dragging Jeremy's body through the exit. The light nearly blinded me, and I began choking immediately upon crossing back into his room, where the air was thinner, warmer, and of a different nature entirely. I had to force myself to remember how to breathe. Breathe in deep. Release. I yanked Jeremy up by the forearm. Both he and I were drenched red with blood. He looked terrifying. A hole had eroded the meat of his cheek, revealing visible molars and a ghastly grin. His eyes were wide orbs, and it took a moment to register the fact his eyelids had deteriorated completely. I caught a glimpse of my own hands and let out a whimper. Two fingers were flayed, split down, revealing the muscle and white, bulbous knuckles within. They trembled as I coughed, and then I vomited what looked to be a pint of blood onto the floor, not far from the puddle we'd emerged from. I tugged Jeremy out as much as I could, but his lower legs were stuck. They remained in that impossible puddle as it dried over completely with a dull glaze, amputating the remainder in that deadly, mysterious realm outside of our own. I cried tears of joy as I heard Jeremy's gurgling gasps for air. He was alive. I wiped the tears with the remaining rags of my shirt, and I called an ambulance, or emergency response, as they stated when they'd answered the phone. Out of the corner of my eye, I stared in disbelief at the strange hardcover book on the floor by a bright yellow wallet and a peculiar-looking device where his phone had been, near the drying pool of blood. I tried to wrap my brain around how it was back with us in the room. I knew I'd left it in there, and this room was eerily clean. Curiosity got the better of me, and I walked over to the wallet, wondering who'd put them there as I switched off that humming oscillator, also somehow different. I picked up the wallet, yellow Velcro, and emblazoned with some local soccer team. I flipped it open in confusion, finding a Colorado license, insurance card, and a few crisp $20 bills within. It was Jeremy's, but he looked clean-cut and almost normal. Colorado? I asked aloud in confusion. He'd never even been there. My mind tried to piece things together, but refused to cooperate as the reality of the situation became more apparent, and far more terrifying as I noticed other details about the now clean room. The kind of cell phone in the pile of his belongings simply didn't exist as far as I knew. I picked up the strange phone, its white plastic shell lined with orange and brown accents, emblazoned with the familiar name Commodore. The shivers throughout my blood-soaked spine multiplied as I then saw the green flashing lights approach the house with a siren that sounded in strange digital bursts. I walked over to the book and picked it up in my butchered, bloody hands and flipped it open to the fifth chapter. I read as my heart pounded in my chest and my vision blurred from tears. Chapter 5. Returning. Little is known about the ability to return to one's plane of origin. While explorers have been documenting these ruptures in the fold for dozens, in some planes, even hundreds of years, there has been nothing to suggest a return is actually possible aside from the fact that nothing suggests it is not. Prepare for a one-way trip each time you travel. I looked out the window to the yellow van marked Emergency Response, lit by the flickering strobe of green LED lights through the leafless trees below. I stumbled and fell to my aching knees, overwrought with trepidation as I realized this was not our world. I had dragged my severely injured cousin from the electromagnetically charged puddle of his own blood. What we came out into was a different version of his home. It happened so quickly that it was hard to even process it. The banging on the door sounded. I know I heard that. I faded in and out of consciousness as I was placed on a stretcher and carefully taken down the stairs by men in fluorescent yellow garb, reminiscent of what a fireman might wear. I tried to ask questions, but even in my fatigued delirium, I knew I wasn't pronouncing any words, just a faint mumble. Either shock or exhaustion helped separate me from the experience as I was loaded into the back of the emergency services van. The strobing bursts of green lit the flawless facade of the alternate home of my cousin. The workers in their yellow vinyl garb were professional and coordinated, assuring me they would get me the treatment needed as soon as possible. They placed a rubbery anesthetic mask over my nose, and I looked into the kind face of a man in his mid-30s who assured me they'd take care of my friend. I tried to correct him by mumbling, "Cousin," but was out before I had a chance. I woke up in a room wallpapered with a lavender floral pattern. I appeared to be in a fairly swanky apartment of sorts. My hazy eyes fixed on the smooth overhead light fixture, then followed the pattern of the wallpaper. It was only when I turned my head fully to the left that I saw the plastic bag with an IV drip. As if on cue, a face I recognized from the ride over walked in. The man was wearing a sweater and slacks, casual attire. "Mr. Stanton, how are you feeling?" he asked with a warm smile as he interlaced his fingers over his stomach. I hadn't even thought about how I was feeling until he'd asked. My pain was gone.
I feel fine, I guess," I spoke, then added, "Where am I?"
"You're with emergency services, Mr. Stanton," the man stated calmly. "I figured you would recognize it, or at least me, after waking up." The smile had slipped off his face, replaced by a look of worry. My fuzzy brain tried to patch together the events, that impossible geometric nightmare that nearly consumed me. My cousin,
Jeremy, is he?
I couldn't even say it. I knew he was gone when I'd seen his eroded face, the bared teeth and eaten eyelids from that terrifying dimensional fold that shouldn't, couldn't exist. "Jeremy will be fine," the man added, walking closer to the side of the bed in a room that looked like a metropolitan apartment, but a bit too pristine. "We have two prosthetics to replace the lost portion of his legs. I'm more concerned about your mental state." The look in his eyes flickered with a coldness that sent shivers up my spine. "You don't recognize me?" he asked sincerely. Something told me to play along, and so I did.
"I'm sorry, I'm just in shock and a bit exhausted," I suggested, hoping to buy some time to piece together just what exactly was going on.
"Of course, I'll check on you after you get some rest," he said, and walked back out of the room, looking back with those concerned eyes that seemed to tell me I'd be better off not remembering. I sighed and then looked to the bureau, where a flat-screen TV and a cactus rested. The nightstand to my left had a call button and a few pamphlets about treatment options and patient rights. I was in what appeared to be a hospital, but lacking all of the uncomfortable sterility that defined them. I found a small remote and figured out how to power on the TV, which I only then realized displayed a clean logo reading Lorimar. I'd never heard of it. I flipped from channel to channel of countless television shows that simply did not exist. There was nothing remarkable for the most part. They were similar reality TV shows and standard films, Bachelor and Home Improvement programming. I even recognized a few of the actors and began to think my fears were just that. Then I stumbled across the news. I watched the TV and a headache formed as I heard the newscaster discuss the citizen states. It only hit me as I watched the weather report and strangely sectioned off districts. This was another version of my world. My heart thumped loudly, triggering the soothing beep for a nurse who soon came in to check on me. A man in a crimson vinyl outfit entered, and he lacked the friendliness of the previous man. I watched the group share ideas around a table for a bit before I understood they were the leaders of the nation. It was a panel of four spokespeople for different demographics, two men and two women, discussing tax ballots at a table, casually sipping coffee. I barely felt the needle in my arm as the nurse slipped it into the thin skin of the crook of my elbow. I was too busy trying to wrap my head around the next segment, where the perfectly coiffed reporter discussed a breaking story. My clenched teeth parted from the calming effect of the drugs entering my veins.
Drool slipped from the corner of my mouth as the medication coursed through my blood, dulling the sharp panic into a cloudy afterthought. My face was there on the news, staring back at me from a picture I'd never taken. It was me, listed as Will Stanton, and I looked bedraggled and angry. I listened to the reporter continue on about the man who'd been missing for months after stealing blood packs from the ES station he worked at. The words scrolling beneath my photo blurred as my heavy eyes closed, and the reporter's soothing voice spoke the velvety words, "unstable fugitive," that finally lulled me to sleep. I woke to the voice of my cousin. It took a while to adjust from my foggy dream to the clean interior of the room. I then remembered the strange hospital. I jolted upright, looking into the deformed face of Jeremy in the doorway. A glaze of repairing ointment of some sort was slathered over his exposed skin, catching the overhead lighting with an eerie glow. The hole in his cheek was a crater of exposed teeth. He looked like something out of a horror movie. He wheeled himself over in a carbon fiber wheelchair that looked light and slimmer than any I'd ever seen, the nubs of his amputated legs bandaged. "I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry," he said, staring with those lidless, bulging orbs of bloodshot eyes. I propped myself up on my elbows, only then looking at my pink arms, also coated with some gel to facilitate a speedy recovery. My blurry eyes focused on a tall figure of shiny crimson behind him. A sturdy-looking employee stood by in that slick vinyl uniform. I only then began to wonder if the red was meant to prevent the staining of blood. "I'm so glad you're alive," I spoke to Jeremy, knowing he needed to hear it. And I was wrong about everything, especially my arrogant assumptions." I spoke with sincerity. I watched Jeremy's head fall forward, looking down since he was unable to close his eyes. "I never meant for anything to happen to you," Jeremy muttered in a shaky voice as his streamlined wheelchair was wheeled backward. "I owe you my life." And he was wheeled out as a large man in a red vinyl uniform entered to read me the equivalent of Miranda rights. The charges against me would lead to appropriate time in a recovery center, this place's term for jail. The man held out a slim tablet of sorts, made by the company Commodore, with patterned plastic that appeared both decades old and futuristic. He held the device with shiny red gloves, displaying a man who looked identical to me breaking into an emergency services building, sifting through records, and pilfering blood packs. I had no case. That was clearly me. Still, questions grew as the screen showed further footage and mounting evidence against me that sent shivers down my spine. The alternate version of me had apparently broken into multiple stations over the course of the year. I'd been apprehended before and taken to a recovery services center already. The frowning man in red said nothing as he held out that screen. I watched as each of my crimes was displayed to ensure I understood the severity of my punishment. The high-definition footage played on, showing my time in the other facility. Sitting there in a red plastic-walled chamber, naked on the floor in the corner. The mirror version of me was crying and screaming about how he didn't belong there, how he was from another place. White text overlaying the screen, displaying the words, "evidence of mental instability," soon switched to yellow to read, "evidence of theft of government property," as another feed showed me procuring what appeared to be a piece of metal from my armpit in a plastic cell devoid of anything but a drain. I watched in shock as the me on that screen cut his arm open, spilling blood to the floor. He then collapsed from blood loss. It was reminiscent of watching Jeremy do the same on my phone screen. The text changed to read, "evidence of self-harm and escaping an ESS," and I watched as my doppelganger's limp body was lifted onto a stretcher and wheeled into a facility like the one I was in now. The man with my face, only then wearing any clothing, a thin hospital gown, managed to work at the rubber restraints until freeing himself from the bed. I watched as a number in the lower left climbed, only then realizing it was the sentencing date accumulating with each offense. The number shifted from a yellow 2 to a yellow 4. I watched as the alternate version of myself on the screen called a worker in, then choked them from behind and stole their key fob for the door. The text shifted to read, "Evidence of assaulting a government employee," and I shivered as I saw the yellow 4 climb to an orange 15. The timestamp of the footage sped up rapidly in the lower right of the Commodore's tablet screen to show hours passing as it fast-forwarded. The collapsed employee shifted on the ground a bit before waking up, then, still slumped on the floor, reached into their pocket. They removed a pill bottle and opened it hastily as the footage returned to normal speed. They dumped the sole pill in the plastic bottle into their hand, then accidentally dropped it. I watched in confusion as to why this particular sequence continued on for so long. The pill rolled under a cabinet. The employee wiggled to try and reach it, but it was clearly too far underneath. The man on the floor struggled a bit as he grabbed at his chest and then collapsed, flat and still. The text shifted to read, "Evidence of causing the death of a government employee." "No," I mouthed as my insides iced over. My gaze shifted to the orange 15, which then vanished from the screen. I then felt the world collapse as the number was replaced by red text reading, "Euthanize." I was too weak to even struggle as the man in the red vinyl uniform bound my wrists with rubber cuffs and lifted me gently to my feet. I tried to speak on my behalf, but the futility of trying was beyond apparent. Everything I could even try to say, he'd heard it all before. I remember being lifted up and frog-marched through the hall. I realized only death awaited me, likely in some lovely postmodern death house. My throat dried, and I was sweating so much. I wondered where the other version of me was who'd come here, realizing he must have somehow opened another window and escaped to some other plane of existence that mostly mirrored our own. I saw the trees and the highways out the window when I heard a loud, meaty banging sound from behind me. I soon fell onto my knees with a jarring pain that pulsed through my bones. I felt the rubber wrist restraints being unfastened. "Take this and run," the familiar voice called from behind me. "Jeremy?" I called back and turned enough to see him seated in that ultra-modern wheelchair. "This is all my fault, and there's no time to argue. There's a group of them around the corner coming to pick you up. I saw them. I'm sorry. Now, run." Jeremy looked down at me from the wheelchair, a mutilated face incapable of any expression but that ghastly grin. In his deteriorated arms was the metal canister of compressed oxygen he'd used to take down the large worker sprawled out cold on the floor. I strained as I lifted my aching body to its feet as the sound of marching boots came closer to the corner. A glance down the red-carpeted hallway showed an exit, marked by a green LED shaped like trees. Jeremy held out a key fob from the fallen employee, and I took it in my butchered hands and swiped it over the reader by the exit door, turning back to face him. I gave him a solemn nod, well aware I'd likely never see him again. Then, I ran outside and into the sunlit unknown. You've just heard A Beginner's Guide to Blood Portals by Michael Squid. Born in Pennsylvania, Michael is a horror author and filmmaker whose work has appeared in a number of anthologies and podcasts. His passion for storytelling and visual arts has led him into the world of filmmaking, where he aims to bring a fresh and dark vision to audiences. Well, my friends, that closes out our tales this evening.
If you've enjoyed Michael's work, he has several collections of short stories over at Velox Books, www.veloxbooks.com, and I recommend that you go give them a look. You never know what glistening little tidbits you might find. Thank you all for joining me tonight, and be sure to tune in next week for more scary stories to keep that chill running up your spine. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.